Welcome to the Investor Coaching Show, a podcast to help you get an insider's view of the financial world and escape common investment traps. We look at the financial news of the day and help you make sense of it so you can relax about money. And here's your host, Paul Winkler.
And welcome. This is the Investor Coaching Show. I'm Paul Winkler, along with Ira Werk, talking money and investing. And we're going to get into some stuff this hour, but it could be fun. I taught a class over at Trevecca. It was a stewardship, financial stewardship. It's a student body over there. And one of the things that was asked to me was, when it comes to personal stewardship, why is investing important? Well, number one, if you think about it, as you get older, you'll get to a point, and the way I answered it, you'll get to a point where you may not want to work, you may not be able to work, you might have not have the mental capacity. I said, all of you have probably known somebody that as they get older, that they just want to go do different things. Their values change, and they want to go and visit grandkids, or they want to travel the country, or to do the things that they've never done before, or they just... their bodies break down. Maybe they used to work in fields where, you know, it was a little bit physical and they can't do that anymore. Or maybe they need mental acuity that's just not there anymore, because what happens is fluid intelligence starts to drop off at about age 45. I didn't talk about this, but this is from the psych world, that fluid intelligence tends to drop off at that particular point in time. And we're not able to do some of the things that we might have been able to do previously in our life, and we might be less effective in our jobs as a result. And then what happens is we're getting paid more at that point in time, and the companies are going, hey, there are younger people that can do your job for a lot less. You get replaced. So there are a lot of reasons. Or your health fails, or your spouse's health. There are a lot of reasons that investing makes sense, because you go through two phases of life. One, you work for money. And then hopefully you get to phase two, where money works for you. And hopefully what you're doing at the first phase is your income exceeds your expenses. So you're saving the difference for that point in time when your expenses exceed your income. And that's the idea behind personal stewardship. Now, when you get into how do you invest, a lot of people leave a significant amount of money on the table because of the way they invest. They fall for things like this, you know, life insurance as an investment, or they fall for socially conscious investing or religiously conscious investing, or they fall for the recency bias thing, where they buy investments based on what just recently did well, or they fall for individual stocks, or they fall for cryptocurrencies, or they fall for things that really aren't investments, or gold or whatever. So what happens is, from a stewardship standpoint, we're given the money that we get from our work, and what we want to do is be that person that uses it to the best advantage of not only ourselves, but our heirs, and maybe even charities that we might give to. Mm-hmm. It's really important. Stewardship is a huge deal, and I love the question for that reason. Okay, question number two. What are some of the ways that ordinary people invest? There are different categories. What are ways that, or now that's a funny question to me, because what do ordinarily people do? What should they do versus what they do? Short version in your mind, Ira, on that.
Well, in my mind, one of the things that they do is they put some money into their retirement account at work.
Right. And that was one of the things I said, 401ks, 403bs, 457 plans, SEP plans, if you're self-employed, or simple plans or something like that. Yeah. So that's normally the way people start out. That's their first experience with investing many times.
I talked to a guy yesterday when I had to pick up my car. It was in the shop. And he said, yeah, I put, you know, just a bare minimum into my 401k at work just to get the match. Mm-hmm. He said, and then I put the rest of the money into CDs because I'm really conservative.
Right. You're taking risks that you don't recognize that you're taking, though, would be my point.
Right.
In that.
Right.
You know, because you don't understand. Because that's one of the things I talked about, inflation risk. I said, you know, what if I put a dollar in treasury bills? And I asked, it was funny because I asked the class, what if you put a dollar in treasury bills in 1926? What do you think that'd be worth now? And one of the guys came up with like $1.3 million or something like that.
Oh, way off.
I was like, yeah. Well, you know, I said, But what I said to him is, I said, thanks for taking a stab at it. I mean, that takes guts
right.
to be the person that steps out and takes a stab at a question like that. Well, so I give you great kudos for that. I said, but the answer is $22.
Well, going back to my example with the insurance being valued at $42,000, had that money just been put into the S&P each month for the same time period, it would have been worth $142,000.
Right, yeah.
$100,000 more.
Well, in the example I gave with that, a dollar grows to $22 versus like over 12, 30, I think it's like up to $14,000 right now is where we're at, is what a dollar would have grown to in the S&P 500. And it's like $22,000 for small caps. It's over $100,000 for small value.
It's
over $100,000 for that. So you look at that and go, whoa, that's a big, big difference between those two. And that's just, you know, historically, that is the return of that asset category. Now, what do people, most people do? Where do they invest? The answer to that would be they invest in the qualified plans. But when they invest in the qualified plans, they tend to, and this is what I taught, is they tend to invest in things that they're familiar with.
Yes, I was going to go there.
Go ahead.
Well, they'll invest in the S&P 500 funds primarily. Or what I'm finding now too is that they're investing in target date funds simply because they don't know what to do. They look at what their age is. They look at about when they're going to retire. And the lazy financial advisor who goes out to set them up on the qualified plan said, well, you're going to be 65 in 2053. Do a 2055 fund.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And if you go out on the internet, go out on YouTube, and you go, how many, like three funds, the only three funds you'll need. You will see videos of the three fund portfolio, simple investing for beginners, Vanguard Life Strategy funds, and I actually used Life Strategy funds to show what a bad thing it had been over the. I did a whole workshop on this, actually using those funds and what would have happened and how much underperformance there would have been doing this particular strategy. But what gets me is you have 265,000 views. Of that video, 391,000 views of the first video that I mentioned. You have 162,000 videos of that one, another one with 23,000 views, a 1.1 million, and basically telling you just to buy a couple of funds, another one with 780,000 views telling you three funds that you want. This is what average people do, is this kind of stuff. And they don't recognize that what they are doing isn't so great. But it sounds good because it sounds so simple. Mm-hmm. But what happens, and the reason that it's a problem, is that what you're doing is you're investing in things that are more familiar to you. But the reality of it is that the level of volatility and the risk is being ignored when it gets down to it. You're ignoring the volatility of those asset classes. You can go long periods of time, 10, 20 years historically, and have zero returns. With the asset categories that they are basically proposing here to invest in, the funds. Because what they're talking about here is investing in index funds that are capitalization weighted. Mm-hmm. What that means is that they're overweighting big companies. And one of the things I taught the kids is I said, guys, girls, ladies, name companies for me. Just give me the names of some companies you might invest in. And they came up with Apple and Amazon, Google. And there were a couple of them, right? Google, you know. And what I said, good enough, you can stop right now. Good, thank you. Okay. Now, what I said was, those companies are what? And they said, well, they're big. They're successful, right? And they said, yes. And I said, do you think, kids, and these people know next to nothing about investing in this classroom. And they're like 19, 20 years old, right? And I said, do you think these companies have to pay a lot to use your money if they borrow it? Mm-hmm. And they said, no. And I said, excellent. Think about it this way. These companies would have lower expected returns because when you're investing in them, you are letting them use your money. So what would that mean about the expected return of these companies long run? And they said, lower. I said, you nailed it. Now, that was the answer to that question. What do ordinary people generally invest in? That. But they don't think about what I just said. And you said it earlier, Ira, the expected long-term return would be lower. Why would it be lower? Because those companies are successful. Now, if you knew about them before they became successful, you would have had something going there.
Right.
But you are now not investing in the companies that will be those companies in the future. Then I asked the kids, do you know what the Dow is? And they're like, in general. And I said, 30 companies, the Dow. And then I said, if you look back in the 1930s at the list of the companies, the very most successful, well-known companies, period, end of sentence, is what would make up the Dow. How many companies are still in the Dow now of those companies? And they were like, they didn't know. I said, well, zero. None of them. And I said, some of these companies, if I named them for you, you'd be going, who is that? And I said, kids, you guys are in your 19, 20, 21 years old, right? I don't know that. You're around that age, right? And I said, it would be like somebody coming up to you and going, grandma, grandpa. And they started laughing when I did that. Grandma, grandpa. Because they're like matching themselves as grandmothers and grandfathers. It's like, it's not happening. But I said, imagine somebody comes up to your kid, comes up to your grandson, granddaughter comes up to you and says, who was Microsoft? That's what it would be like. When you look at the Dow companies back in the 1930s, they were the big dogs of that decade.
Well, I actually had an example, not an example, but I actually had something like that happen to me in a very different way. You know, I was sitting with my daughter watching TV, and the Jackson 5 came on. Mm-hmm. And she was like, who are they?
Who are they?
It made me feel so old.
That's bad. I know.
Yeah, I think she was like 7 years old.
So true. I mean, yeah, that's a great example. And, you know, companies. And then I pointed out the statistic, Ira, that I pointed out before here. If you look at the length of time that companies stayed in the S&P 500, you know, 40, 50 years ago.
Oh, it's a
they were in the index, but you know they were in there for 50 years, 60 years. And I says the average staying time for companies being in the 500 biggest companies in the United States is like less than 18 years now. Companies come and go much more rapidly.
And you're thinking about companies that actually are big darlings of Wall Street and have something and they don't know what they have, so they sell it. And that company that bought it blows it out of the water. And the company that sold it to them is almost non-existent today.
Mm-hmm.
And can you think of a company that I'm thinking about?
Well, I think like Kodak.
That's exactly what I was thinking about.
Yeah.
You know, they invented the digital camera and they were in the film business.
Yeah.
And they're like, we don't need this. We're in the film business.
Sure.
And today we walk around with digital cameras in our pockets.
Right.
Connected to our phone, which is also connected to our calculator. And we have all of these devices in one simple thing, which could have almost gotten rid of a number of different industries.
So we're going to have some more fun with this. There are more questions coming right after this. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the Investor Coaching Show right here on SuperTalk 99.7 WTN. Going through questions that I was asked teaching a class over at Trevecca. And we'll just give you some of our answers to these things. This was a lot of fun. Thanks for tuning in to the Investor Coaching Podcast. Now, you may be one of these people that's been listening and realizing, wow, investing, there's a lot more to it than meets the eye, and financial planning, tax laws constantly changing, and recognizing that maybe you might need some help in this area, but you don't want just anybody to help you out. So we have 10 offices in the Middle Tennessee area, and everything we do is fee only. We align our interests with your interests. So you can get an initial 15-minute phone call with any one of our offices just by going to paulwinkler.com/call. That's it. Every one of the offices is run by somebody with 20-plus years experience. They're all degree planners. They all have academic backgrounds in investing, and you can get the help that you need. So if you want to set up a complimentary phone consultation, just go to paulwinkler.com/call. And we look forward to seeing you soon. All right, back here on the Investor Coaching Show, Paul Winkler, along with Ira Work, Talking Money and Investing. PaulWinkler.com is the website to find out more about what we do. You can literally get on the schedules of any of the people that run the offices around town. We got 10 of them, so if we don't have one close to you, you must not live around here. And we have one in Bowling Green, too, so it could be around there. Or in Texas, but you're probably not down there.
Or probably not listening.
Probably asking, why on earth do you have a place in Texas? Well, that's a long story. It happens to be where my parents lived before I was born, which is crazy. But that's not the reason that we have an office in Texas. So anyway, the thing that we're talking about is actually was asked to do, and I'm going to be doing this again pretty soon as well. I love going over and I love teaching college students that don't know a lot about investing because, A, you can get them to spare them the problems of messing up with their investments. And what a big deal that is. The vast majority of underperformance when it comes to investment advisors, investors, the public has to do with behavior and misinformation. And you look out there and you go, oh my goodness, there's so much information overload. And so much of the information contradicts. You know, that's one of the things that I always get. Why are there so many different opinions on what to do? And it really, there are a lot of different opinions because most of the investment research or the investment advice out there or the opinions on what you ought to do with your investments is driven by what is called a markets fail or market inefficiency approach to investing. And that is where most of the information comes from, is that because that is how Wall Street makes the greatest amount of money, is having you engage in those types of activities. And hence, a lot of investment people and mutual fund companies, it's like Burt Malkiel from Princeton put it. He says, I don't believe it's a scam. He says they truly believe that they have these abilities. Evidence is that they don't. And a lot of it comes down to cognitive biases and mistakes that people make around money is cognitive biases or issues that happen inside their stinking thinking, their brain. Most of the things that you do, you know, if you look at the world of psychology, this is something that I've I've been talking to some of the professors at Trevecca about. And I says, I got this idea. I have this idea, and several of them are like, really, they want to know more about, let's do something like this. And we'll just see where it ends up. I don't know where it's going to end up. But I want to take some of these psychological concepts and combine it with investing in ways that it's being done a little bit right now, but I think it needs to be done in a whole different way. I think there's a whole better way to actually train financial advisors than is being done right now. So that'll be something I think we're going to work on. I'm like writing down these ideas, and I've told several of the powers that be over there, says, let's get together, and they're excited about it. So I love the folks over there. But anyway, so doing this thing, and the question was, okay, so what's a dividend? Was the next question. That's a fairly easy one.
It's money that the company pays you for owning the stock. It's part of the profits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, part of the earnings of the company. It's a subset of the earnings. Some of the earnings are plowed back into the company so that they can move into new territories. They can invest in equipment. Sometimes they buy back the stock of their own company. There are a lot of things that they can do with those earnings. But a dividend is something paid back to you. Now, if a dividend is high compared to the share price, you may be actually investing in very distressed companies. A lot of people don't recognize that. They think, oh, I'm going to have a high dividend paying strategy to get an income in retirement. And they don't recognize that they're actually taking tremendous risk because they're investing in distressed companies. So that was the answer to that question. Next question. Over time, how much has the stock market generated return-wise? What has been the returns? And I'll take this simply because I did the calculations beforehand and I had a little fun with this one. So I'm talking to college students. What do college students do a lot of? Buying lattes. They buy coffee, right? To stay awake during their classes. So I use this example with them. I said, let's say that the latte costs $5, okay? And you have $5 per day that you spend on your coffee. That works out to, if you got 365 days in a year, you spend $1,825 per year on lattes. So I said, what if you took that and you invested it over a 40-year period? Because these people are in their 20s, early 20s, right? So we're just taking that over that period of time. What would it have grown to taking 40-year return data is what I did. And I did the S&P 500 was the first asset category that I used. The answer for the S&P 500 was it would have grown to $907,000. How about small companies? 1.6 million. Not quite double, but it's not too terribly far off, right? So as Ira said earlier, you know, the return of the market, that part of the market that most people invest in was significantly lower. Then I took it into, I put it into value companies as measured by the Russell 1000 value. It came to 1.4 million, significantly higher than the S&P 500 again. And then it was 2.8 million with small value. So it was literally about a little bit over three times as much money. Okay. So the answer to that, how much, it depends on the stock market segment. And one of the things that you find is that historically what we do is if we invest in these market segments, and this is what won the Nobel Prize in economics in 1990, you can end up with a portfolio with a much higher return historically, much higher than the S&P 500, with a fraction of the risk. And that's why it won the Nobel Prize for economics, is because, whoa, nobody, you know, nobody but nobody. I mean, literally, they didn't want to actually give Markowitz the they didn't want to give him his doctorate, forget the Nobel Prize, when he first came out with that, because they thought it was kind of crazy what he was doing, using correlations and how things moved with and against each other to put a portfolio together.
But you know what? Here's the really crazy thing about that. He actually earned his PhD for that dissertation in 1952.
Yeah.
So this data, this information,
isn't new.
Has been around for over 70 years.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what infuriated me about the industry, is this data was there.
Yeah.
I was trained by the industry. They never trained me about this information where I could have been building successful portfolios for my clients from when I started in this business in 1984. And instead, I almost stumbled. I would say I almost stumbled on it by accident in 2000.
Yeah. And the thing is, Ira, it's not that they didn't tell you about the research or that the Nobel Prize was awarded for it or what it was awarded for, they misused it for sales purposes. Like, think of the Brinson, Hood, and Bebauer study. How were you actually taught the Brinson, Hood, and Bebauer study?
I was not taught it when I started this.
You weren't taught it. I was taught it. I was taught it, but I was taught incorrectly.
Yeah. No.
You know, that 94% of your performance of your portfolio is due to asset allocation. And the other two things, we can increase the returns using those things, right?
You know,
and which is, how do you pick the stocks that are going to go in the portfolio, and how do you use tactical asset allocation?
Yeah,
it was just mistaught.
Yeah, when I went through some training with Shearson in 93, they were talking about putting together portfolios using asset allocation and then timing certain areas, getting in, getting out, and then it moved more to tactical asset allocation. We'll just move and shift from area to area rather than get out.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work.
Unreal. Hey, this is Paul Winkler. Hope you enjoyed today's edition of the Investor Coaching Show. If you want to learn more about what we do, go to our website, paulwinkler.com. You can watch some of the videos there, and if you're not already a client, you can set up a free initial consultation. Until next time, I'm Paul Winkler, reminding you that I believe that more educated investors are more competent investors, and confident investors are more successful investors. Have a great one. Advisory services offered through Paul Winkler, Inc., an SEC-registered investment advisor. The opinions voiced and information provided in this material are for general informational purposes only and not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine what investments are appropriate for you, please consult with a financial advisor. Paul Winkler, Inc. does not provide tax or legal advice. Please consult your tax or legal advisor regarding your particular situation.